And the worst thing that we can do today in this recession is to limit the potential energy in our businesses by overtaxing them, overregulating them, prohibiting entrepreneurs from starting new businesses. And unfortunately, our government does that at the state, federal, and local levels all the time. I'm Tim Sandifer. I'm a principal attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, headquartered in California, and I'm the author of The Right to Earn a Living, Economic Freedom and the Law. My book focuses on the history of the right to make one's own economic choices, the right to economic freedom, which was protected by English and American courts as far back as the 17th century, and was well understood and highly regarded by the founding fathers, and is a central part of the liberty that the Constitution protects. You know, a lot of time you hear people talk about economic freedom as an unenumerated right. Well, it's not an unenumerated right. Liberty is an enumerated right in the Constitution, and liberty includes the right to make one's own choices about a variety of things, including the right to make economic choices, what to buy and sell, what to earn, what jobs to take or not take, and that sort of thing. What happened during the New Deal was the climax of a gradual transformation of the law. Often we talk about the New Deal as being a sudden change in American law, but what it really was the constitutionalization of the philosophy of progressivism, of the progressive interpretation of the Constitution, that began around the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And it began with people like Oliver Wendell Holmes or Louis Brandeis, who at first were writing dissenting opinions, right? Holmes famously dissented in the case of Lochner versus New York. Brandeis wrote all these famous dissenting opinions. In 1934, what happened is that their ideas became American law. And there were four big progressive ideas. The first one was that rights are just permissions. Rights aren't entitled to rights because you're human. Rights are something society gives you for its own purposes. The second idea was that government exists to make society nice. The founders thought that government exists only to protect individual rights. But the progressives came up with all sorts of new ideas for how to make society nice: eugenics, prohibition, segregation, income tax, all of these wonderful new ideas for how to control society and make it better. Zoning. When we talk about eminent domain, for instance, it was the progressives who first used the word blight to describe neighborhoods. And blight originally is the term for a plant disease, right? But the progressives used it to talk about neighborhoods because they imagined society as a plant and government as the gardener that goes around and prunes the garden and makes it nice. The third great progressive idea was judicial restraint, that when government decides to violate your rights, courts should do nothing about it. And then the fourth great progressive idea was the living Constitution. So those four progressive ideas became American law in 1934 in a case called Nebbia versus New York. And in Nebbia, what the court did was it invented the so-called rational basis test. Rational basis means government does whatever it wants and gets away with it. As long as some politician thought it was a good idea, the thing is constitutional. That's the rational basis test. And since 1934 to the present day, that's the test that's applied when it comes to economic freedom or private property rights. Now, when you're talking about rights that the left cares about, things like freedom of speech, you tend to get a higher level of protection from courts. But when we're talking about economic liberty and private property rights, courts simply look the other way in the vast majority of cases. There are exceptions, of course. But because of the rational basis test, which is nowhere to be found in the Constitution, because of that, people's economic freedoms in this country are at risk from legislatures that can do whatever they want. I love talking about Nebbia because it's such an incredibly stupid decision. What happens is 1934, it's the depths of the Great Depression, unemployment is, 25% or something, and the state of New York, of course, knows how to solve this problem. Obviously, the solution is right before our eyes, and that is you have to make food more expensive, right? So that's what they do. They pass a law saying you're not allowed to charge less than, I believe it's 8 cents a quart for milk. And Leo Nebbia, a Rochester grocery store owner, sells milk for less than 8 cents a quart. And he's brought up on charges for it. And the U.S. Supreme Court says, yeah, you can punish him for that, because if the government wants to regulate the economy, it can do virtually anything it wants to. So the rational basis test that was basically concocted out of thin air by the progressive movement, and gradually, but applied to American law with no constitutional basis. That's why you have cases like Kelo or these law licensing restrictions that prohibit people from earning an honest living. What are the primary abuses of economic liberties? I would say the most obvious one is antitrust law, which is a murky swamp of precedent that nobody can interpret or understand, that where the same behavior can be characterized as a pro-competitive good thing for the consumer or as an anti-competitive crime against the people, depending entirely on spin and on how broadly you draw the circle. An example that I give in the book about this is when the Nestle Corporation tried to buy Dreyer's ice cream. Now, for Nestle to buy Dreyer's is obviously not a monopoly in the ice cream business. There's plenty of ice cream manufacturers and there's no problem. So what the Federal Trade Commission did was it simply created a new category of ice cream that it called super premium ice cream, which I guess means really good ice cream, in which case there's only Dreyer's and Breyers, and now it's a monopoly for Nestle to buy Dreyer's, you see. So it depends entirely on how broadly you decide to characterize the market. You can create an offense against the laws of the United States. I'm currently representing a moving company in Missouri in a lawsuit where the licensing law in Missouri says if you want to start a moving company, you first have to get permission from all the existing moving companies. What happens is you apply for a permit, and the government notifies all the existing moving companies and gives them the opportunity to object. And if they object, you have to go to a board of bureaucrats and prove to them that there ought to be a new moving company. How do you prove that there ought to be a new moving company? Before Starbucks went into business, how could they have proved to anybody that we need a new coffee shop? Wouldn't you have said there's plenty of coffee shops out there? So it's impossible to prove this. What it does is it gives existing businesses the opportunity to prevent fair competition from entrepreneurs in a business that is a prime example of the kind of entry-level business that immigrants and the poor tend to gravitate to. And this is a point that, unfortunately, a lot of liberals tend to ignore, which is that the people who need constitutional protection for economic liberty the most are the poor and members of minority groups. It's not rich white guys who are driving taxi cabs. Unfortunately, just about all the Supreme Court justices are hostile to the idea of economic liberty, with the possible exception of Justice Clarence Thomas. But even Justice Thomas treats the idea of protecting rights under the Due Process Clause with unwarranted skepticism. And as a result, even he is questionable on the question of economic freedom. During the oral argument in McDonald versus Chicago, one of the justices asked, well, if we restore the Privileges or Immunities Clause, why wouldn't that mean we'd be protecting economic liberties? As though this is a damning question. To which the answer is, yes, of course, and the Constitution does protect economic liberty. Economic liberty was the first thing mentioned in the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which was passed before the 14th Amendment by the same Congress and for the same reasons. And unfortunately, the justices, you know, they know very well that the New Deal precedents that abandoned protections for economic liberty are central to the regulatory welfare state that we have today. And their primary loyalty is to preserving the regulatory welfare state and not enforcing the Constitution of the United States.